Hello and welcome to a podcast called Two Chairs Talking. This is episode 13. Hope it's not unlucky. And my name is David Grieg, and my co-host, as always, is Perry Middlemiss. Hi, Perry. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks, David. Not too bad at all.
Jolly good. Well, there's quite a few things we want to cover today, and we'll see whether we get across them all. We want to revisit our quirky little idea of visiting or revisiting ancient Hugo Awards in something we call the Hugo Time Machine, which we'll do very shortly. And we also want to talk about some controversies to do with the Hugos and associated awards. So that should be fun. And we also have a bit of a chat about what we've been reading recently. So if we can get all of that in, that'll be good. So I thought we might start with talking about what we've been reading lately. Do you have anything you've watched or seen that you'd want to mention, Perry, or will I go into my little riff?
Oh, I think you better go into it. Most of the stuff that I'm reading seems to be the size of a brick at the moment. And I've got three or four of these things on the go, and I don't seem to be completing anything very much lately. But this stuff will come up later on, and I'll talk about it in a couple of weeks.
Sure. Well, I guess if a book is the size and weight of a brick, then it better be good for you to get all the way through to the end of it.
Oh, well, I can let you know that one of them is the latest George Martin Songs of Fire and Ice book. Oh, yeah. Well, it isn't one of the novels. This is the history of part of the kings of Westeros, and that is, I don't know, 700 or 800 pages or something.
Yeah.
And so it's a fairly hefty. It's a hefty tome, and it's going to take me a while to get through it, but hopefully I'll be able to have a chat about it next week.
Terrific.
Or next time.
Okay, terrific. Well, what I wanted to talk about was a particular author I've become rather keen on recently, and that's someone called Ian Tregillis. He's an American author, and he's written a couple of trilogies. In fact, one of them is called A Triptych, and both of them are very good. The one that he wrote first is the better of the two, I think, which is interesting. The second one isn't quite as good. But the first one he wrote is a thing called what he calls the Milkweed Triptych. Now, this is a book that if you were to just read a simple synopsis, you'd go, oh, ho, ho, hum, I've heard all of that before. That sounds really boring. So that kind of brief synopsis would be, it's World War II. A mad Nazi scientist has been raising children and experimenting on their brains to give them psychic powers. And in England, to counter this terrible new threat, a series of warlocks are raising the demonic forces to fight back against the Nazis. So stated as boldly as that, you say, oh yeah, what a lot of total rubbish. But, in fact, these books are extremely good, and it's nowhere near as stereotypical as I've made it sound, rather deliberately made it sound. So, when the first book opens, this is called Bitter Seeds, and it was written in 2010, or came out in 2010, we're at the very start of World War II, and we discover this, we come across a character called Raybold Marsh, sometimes called Pip, Raybold Marsh, and he is in military intelligence, and he's been sent to Spain during the Spanish Civil War to try and recover some documents that have been abstracted by a spy, basically, from Germany. And he tries to pick up this briefcase, tries to get hold of this briefcase from this particular spy. The spy is very nervous, and just as the briefcase is handed over, there's a burst of flame, and the spy is consumed by flame. However, Marsh manages to grab what's left of the briefcase and takes it home. And in there is the remains of a 16mm film, movie film. And they piece it together in the UK and watch this film. And it's a whole series of views of these Germans who've been given these extreme powers by essentially having their brains rewired, and they have enormous range of different abilities, each of the individuals who have been raised from a child. almost like in an orphanage, have been given different powers. Some of them can walk through walls, some of them can burst into flame, some of them have other powers. And so then in England, there's a setup to try and counter this looming threat. So the Second World War begins, and we find out fairly soon that this is an alternate history version of the Second World War. And that's things are going very badly for the British. The troops at Dunkirk in this history are not evacuated, and thousands and thousands of them hundreds of thousands of them are either captured or killed, so essentially wiping out Britain's forces. So things are looking very, very dire for the British. And so in order to try to redress the balance, they try to take desperate means. And they manage to discover that there is a group of people called warlocks who are able to call upon these strange powers. Now, these powers are not simply demonic powers. They're creatures called Eidolons, who apparently live between space and time. They actually don't live in space and time. They're kind of extraneous to space and time. And they're very hostile to humanity. But it's possible to negotiate with them to get them to do something for you, but only at the cost of a price. And the price is a blood price. And the more severe the effect you want them to create, the more demanding they are of this blood price. People have to die in order for them to actually carry out their not quite magic, but to carry out their powers. So that again still isn't sounding like a really interesting thing, but it's all really down to the characters that the author conjures up. And there's some really interesting interactions between all these characters. And what you start to get is this very interesting thread, because one of the German young people who've been given these powers or been surgically altered to have these powers is a young woman called Gretel, and her power is that she can foresee the future accurately and in detail. And it's as the series of books go on, you see that she's a key character in all this, who's actually trying to shape the way that the future that will become. She can not only see the future but make changes to change things to the future she wants. And she's quite an evil character in many ways. She's very ruthless in what she'll do in order to get what she wants. And so that's really interesting so far. The second book, we get to the end of World War II, and by calling on these Eidolons, the British are able to defeat the Germans by creating the coldest cold snap you can possibly imagine across all of Europe. Across all of Germany, and the Germans finally give in because they're just literally freezing to death. So that's that so far. Then you get to the second book, which comes forward, what would it be, 20, 30 years, to the 1960s. And you're now in a Cold War with the Russians. And the Russians have gone in, like in the real history, where the Russians came in and took a lot of the German rocket scientists. The Russians this time have come in and taken a lot of the scientists who were involved with this special program to raise these amazing powers in people, and now are sort of building up those powers themselves. And then finally, at the end of that book, you have the Eidolons getting more and more power and more and more power because of all these blood prices that are being paid to get their cooperation, and they actually hate humanity. But they haven't been able to locate humanity. They're not in space and time, and they haven't been able to track down humanity in order to get rid of them. Every time there's a blood price paid, they get closer and closer to figuring out where we are in the sort of space-time matrix. And at the end of that book, they actually succeed in locating humanity, and the results are not good. But at the end of that, before you go any further, Gretel, this young woman who's been able to see the future, has seen this coming, and she's able to to jiggle things so that one of the characters that we'll be following, this Raybould Marsh, is sent back in time to the beginning of the Second World War as an older person and to meet up with his younger self. I'm doing a very bad job of explaining how these books work, but all I can say is that the clever plotting, the really interesting background, the really interesting characters and their relationships between all these characters is really well worth following, and I thoroughly recommend them. So that's the first. So does that all sound absolute garbage, Perry? I can hear scoffing noises in the background.
No, it's just that occasionally every now and again you brought up something and I thought, hang on, this sounds a bit like the X-Men.
There is that sort of sense to it in some ways, yeah.
Yeah, so it sounded a bit like sort of Marvel superheroes in some ways. Not that that is to denigrate them at all, but I'm just wondering, you've obviously found something there that has really piqued your interest, yep. Especially, as you say, in terms of the writing style, the characters and the interactions.
Yeah.
So he's obviously taken a sort of a superhero trope, if you like, and then expanded it and written a sort of a literary novel around it. A literary trilogy around it. So it makes it sound interesting. As to whether I ever find the time to read it, don't know. Sure. So many things on the list, but anyway.
I guess it's probably I've probably given a bad impression of the way the German people with these powers have reacted to this, because really they've been given these powers by some terrible surgery and by really put in situations where they're forced to develop some sort of talent to get out of the situation they're in. So, for example, the man who was able to burst into flame has been put in essentially in a coffin as a child, been put into a coffin and put into a freezer. And so with these additional wires in his brain, he's had to be forced to develop the ability to save himself from freezing to death by being able to generate his own heat. And the chap who can walk through walls has been put into a smaller and smaller container, suffering claustrophobia, but again, eventually developing this ability to move through the side of the coffin and escape that way, and therefore has developed these sort of powers. So it's cleverly done. And I definitely can recommend them. The other trilogy that he wrote, which is more recent, and it's not quite as good, I don't think, but it's still very interesting, is called The Alchemy Wars. And it's an alternate history where somewhere in the 16th century, something like that, 16th, 17th century, in Holland, Christian Huygens has come up with a means of essentially using clockwork and alchemy together to be able to create robots, what we would call robots, but this book they're called the Mechanicals. And they're human-like figures, all run by clockwork, but they have some sort of alchemical gem in them, which gives them consciousness. But of course, they're treated as absolute slaves. And there's a whole kind of parallel thing here with slavery and servitude and so on, which is quite cleverly done. But because Holland has come up with this technology, they have had immense power because they can use these mechanicals as soldiers, almost invulnerable soldiers. And using this military power, this new military power, they've overtaken most of Europe. And they've conquered France in particular. And the French what's left of the French court has had to flee to Quebec over the seas in order to get away from the mechanical forces of the Dutch. So the war between the Dutch and the French is in fact still going on. And the French are developing new techniques to try to defeat the hordes of mechanicals that are being sent against them. Things like they're developing their knowledge of chemistry, and so they've built up their knowledge of chemistry so they can have special glues and special acids which work very rapidly on these mechanical beings that are attacking them, these clockwork beings which are attacking them. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that there, in these books, there are two strong female characters who are on opposing sides. One of them is the head of the spy network for the French, and the other strong woman is the woman who's in charge of the Clockwork Makers Guild in Holland. And these two characters are opposed to each other all the way through the trilogy, and their interplay is a very interesting one. And so these series of three books are about those hell wars. But we actually follow one of the mechanicals. In the first book, we actually see from the point of view of one of these mechanicals who eventually is able to get rid of the controlling forces over him and actually start to have free will. And that that seed of free will eventually spreads to other mechanicals, and we end up with a rebellion, which it's very cleverly done. And so I can definitely recommend those as well. It wasn't quite as dark and edgy as the Milkweed Triptych, but it was still pretty good. So I definitely can recommend them. There's one other of his books that I haven't read, but just the synopsis it really makes me think I really got to go out and read this. And this is a book called Something More Than Night, and here's the synopsis. I'm just going to quote the synopsis. A Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler-inspired murder mystery set in Thomas Aquinas's vision of heaven. It's a noir detective story starring fallen angels, the heavenly choir, nightclub stigmatics, dirty priests, swell dames, and the voice of God. That's a wonderful synopsis.
Well, that actually sounds pretty interesting. I could probably come at that one. That might actually be a good introduction. So rather than jumping headlong into one of the other trilogies, get into this one. So what was the name of the book again?
It's called Something More Than Night, and the author's name is Ian Tregillis, which I haven't heard before. And the only reason I discovered these books was through Twitter and Dave Hutchinson, who wrote the Europe in winter, the Europe in autumn, and so on books, the Fractured Europe series.
Fractured Europe.
Yeah, he was talking about them on Twitter, so I went and got them. So there you go.
Well, the question I wanted to ask you about that actually leads into another question, one that I've been thinking of asking you at some point. We discussed a while back whether you were a serial or a parallel reader.
Yep.
When you come across a new author and you find that they have written a trilogy or even, heaven forbid, 4, 5, 6, 8, or 10 books in a series, is it your general pattern that you would start to read that author and continue to keep reading him in fairly close succession, or would you have a gap between each of the books in the series?
In other words, do I binge read? It depends.
There's the thing. Yeah. Do you binge read, or do you just basically I'll take a little while, pace it out?
It depends a bit on the author. I prefer not to binge read too, because you end up just having just one particular author's point of view in your head the whole time. And I try to mix things up mostly. So, for example, with Michael Robotham, I've been really reading his books in a very spaced out sort of way. So, but if I found someone who I think was really over the top good, I'd probably read two or three of their books in a row. I mean, with these trilogies, it was a no brainer because I just wanted to read each of the trilogies to their conclusion, and I read those pretty much one after the other. Maybe with one or two books in between. I think I'd have to look back at my reading list. So it wasn't. I don't think I actually read them bang one after exactly after the other. But there was certainly only a book in between. Some other book in between.
Yeah, I think for me it's partly a matter of, well, okay, how did the first one go, and also how big was it? If it's going to be 600 or 800 pages, or even 1,000 pages, heaven forbid, you sort of think, this is a fair amount of effort that I've put into. And as you said, you've got the one author's voice in your head the whole time.
Yeah.
And if that's taken you a couple of weeks to read, and let's say there's three of them at 1,000 pages a pop, then you're talking about 6 weeks in a row. And so I'd find that a bit difficult. And I also find that some authors have a tendency to reuse the same phrase. So from one book to the next, when you separate the books out over a period of time, the fine nuance of the writing can actually fade away from you a little bit. But if you were to read, say, five Jack Reacher novels in a row, you would probably find that Lee Child uses a particular phrasing or a particular phrase at least once in every one of those books.
Yep.
And about the fourth or fifth time you go, hey, I've read this before. Yep, and, you know, that can sort of start standing out and can start being a little annoying. I know, to give you an example, I remember way back when in the 70s, I read a number of Desmond Bagley books in a row. I don't know whether you remember Desmond Bagley. He was an English thriller writer of the sort of around about the time of Len Deighton, a bit after Ian Fleming. And he used to write these sort of espionage-style books. And he kept on always using the phrase, pure as the driven snow.
Yeah.
And if you read three in a row, you think, oh, I've heard this before.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes just grate with you just a little bit. And so sometimes I think that I've got to be wary of doing that. Although, as we were talking about last week, when we were talking about the Connie Willis, I found that I had too much of a gap between the two books.
Yes.
Because that was really one novel split into two volumes.
Yeah, that was...
And it literally just flowed straight on. It was basically as if, you know, like one conversation finished, you finish a chapter, you move on to the next chapter, and you could have just picked up the next book and just kept on going and read it all as a, you know, 1,000-page, 1,200-page novel.
Yeah.
And that probably would have been a better way to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But frankly, I just couldn't face the second one after I'd got through the first immediately. But then again, Garth Nix's Old Kingdom books I read. I was overseas one time, had them on my e-reader and read three of those all in a row because they all seemed to fit very, very nicely. It just ran straight through. But frankly, that's probably about the last one of those trilogies that I, or a series of books that I can remember reading three in a row without a break.
Yeah. No, I think you do need to give yourself a bit of mind space usually between books. Yeah.
Yep. And now it's time for
the Hugo Time Machine.
This week we wanted to talk about the 1956 Hugo Awards, which were presented at the 14th World Science Fiction Convention, NICON 2, held in New York at the end of August and into the beginning of September 1956. Now, these Hugo Awards were given out for works that were published in 1955, theoretically, but we actually have something a little bit different for that this year, and I'm not terribly sure whether the time period over which the Hugo Awards covered in 1956 is the same as it is now. Now it's just a straight calendar year, and I'll explain why this is a bit of a problem in just a minute when we come to the first awards. The Nebula Awards used to cover part of one year and part of the next, which is a real pain because trying to work out what's good in a year, and you find out that an award is given to the Nebula Award is given to two novels published in the one year, but given in two different years. If you get my drift, can be a little bit disconcerting. So anyway, we're here to talk about the 1956 Hugos. The first, the big one, as everybody refers to it, is the Hugo Award for the novel. This was presented to Double Star by Robert A. Heinlein. Have you read this one, David?
I have. I reread it quite recently.
And what was your view about it?
Well, for a start, I don't think it's one of Heinlein's best novels. Or certainly not his best novel, and really, when you look at it, it's the plot is basically The Prisoner of Zenda, isn't it? There's an actor who's not quite kidnapped, but he's persuaded to stand in for the leader of it's actually like a solar system wide president or something, isn't he? He's a major political figure anyway.
Yeah,
and. There's something
in the solar system, yeah.
That's right. And there's something going on Mars that if he doesn't turn up for this it will be a real disaster, and the whole relationship with the Martian aliens will be really, really bad, and they'll give us away for another couple of centuries and so on. So it's absolutely imperative that he turns up for this particular ceremony. And again, this is an absolute match to The Prisoner of Zenda, where the king has been kidnapped, or the heir apparent to the throne of Ruritania has been kidnapped, and if he doesn't turn up for the coronation, then it's all off and someone else gets to be the king. And so they bring in a chap who's a distant relation who looks like the king. So it's very, very similar in terms of the plot mechanisms. So the actor is persuaded, does attend the ceremony on Mars. All goes well, it's all fine. But the kidnappers then have a couple of more twists to what they're trying to do, and it gets more and more complicated, and things go on from there. And it ends up with a very, very predictable ending. I'm not sure if this is how The Prisoner of Zenda ends, because it's a long, long time since I read that. But things go on, and you can eventually see that this character is going to end up having to take the place of the leader more and more and more. And that's the concept. But it's there's not really that much science fictiony about it, really. It's another one of those stories or novels where the setting is in space or in the solar system or on other planets, but it's not really necessary to the basics of the plot. What did you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's light Heinlein, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're really probably written in 55, but not published until the first few months of 56, which is why I found this a bit weird that it ended up with a 56 Hugo, although maybe the February Astounding, where it first, February 56 Astounding, maybe that hit the newsstands in December. Maybe that was the saving grace. I don't know. Anyway, written in 55, up until then, the bulk of Heinlein's novels had been in the sort of young adult juvenile realm, and he was starting to move away from all of those things that he had written there. And maybe this is just his first progression away from that, or major progression away from it, and that's maybe why it's rather light. The characterization of the main character, Lawrence Smith, the great Lorenzo, as he's billed as an actor, isn't bad. I quite enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's reasonably well written, for what it is. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember actually if there are any women in the whole bloody thing.
Oh yes, there is.
There are a couple, and most of them are probably lightweight.
There's a key character who's again I've forgotten the name of the political leader, but she's been his secretary, and has been in love with this leader. And so she really resents Lawrence Smith acting the part. And there's quite a lot of quite interesting interactions. So she's no total lightweight.
Okay. Well, at least his politics, sexual politics at least, isn't as icky as it was and it turned out to be in the late 60s and 70s. Yes. When he got older, he just went off.
There was something going on there in his head. You kind of wonder.
There was something really weird going on. But anyway, it's just interesting to see what it was up against. So it was up against Eric Frank Russell's Call Him Dead, otherwise known as Three to Conquer.
Oh, yes, I've read that.
I think I know of it as Three to Conquer. I don't know about Call Him Dead. Serialised in Astounding Science Fiction. Isaac Asimov's The End of Eternity, which is a time travel.
Yeah, which is not bad.
Cyril Cornbluth's Not This August.
Don't know that one.
And Lee Brackett's The Long Tomorrow. And Lee Brackett would be, well, given that the previous Hugo Awards in 53 and 55 didn't actually list any nominations, she's the first woman to be nominated for a Hugo Award.
Yeah.
But I haven't read The Long Tomorrow. May have to go back and do that at some point. So that was what he was up against. All Americans, which is pretty much the way that it was at that point, because we're dealing with the major science fiction was coming out of the US, with some out of the UK, but the bulk of the people that went to the conventions and voted were from the US, and so it was bound to be one that they knew, and that's fair enough.
Yep.
And that's basically what happened.
Yeah.
So that's the novel. Now the novelette won by Murray Leinster for his novelette Exploration Team. This was also published in Astounding Science Fiction, and I've just read this just recently.
Oh, yeah.
I can give you at least a little bit about it.
Sure.
It's basically a science fiction story, and it has a lot more science fictional elements to it than Double Star, that's for sure. So it's set on sometime in the future on an alien planet. The beings on Earth have basically started to move out and go around through the galaxy, settling on particular planets all over the place. And as is usual with a lot of these things, whenever they find a planet that they can land on, it's either completely covered with aliens or there's absolutely nothing there at all. But whatever happens, you can still breathe the air and everything's hunky-dory. A little strange. But anyway, let's just skip over that little point. So basically what happens is that on this particular fictional planet of Lauren, or Lauren 2, because I guess probably the Lauren is the name of the star, has been deemed off limits by the Colonial Survey Agency. So nobody is supposedly allowed to land on it. However, and this is basically because there's an alien creature on there which is very, very ferocious, very carnivorous, and basically just wipes out anybody that turns up. But the Colonial Survey has, in fact, actually put a number of people landing it there to actually set up a colony to see whether it is going to be possible to actually live on the place. However, at the same time, a nearby planet, which is running into population problems, has also put out a survey team, one human, and with five companions. Four of them are genetically modified or bred Kodiak bears who act as helpers and assistants to the man running the survey, and he also has an eagle. So either this is these are animals that have come through from Earth that have been modified over the centuries and have now been included in this survey. What ends up happening is that somebody from the Colonial Survey comes to the planet. They are ostensibly looking for their particular group, but only find him, turn up, and then start talking to him and say, well, you're really not supposed to be here, but where are the other guys? And so this guy that's there on his own says, well, I don't know, I didn't know they were here. Maybe we can try and find them. And he figures out a way of being able to see whether they're there, tracks them down. And then the story talks about how the Colonial Survey representative and this other bloke, Huygen, his name is, do a cross-country trip from his base over to the other base to try and track them down and find them. There's not a lot that goes on here that is tremendously amazing stuff. It's basically a classic Astounding Science Fiction story where whatever the alien wildlife is going to be, humans are going to be able to prevail. That's exactly what Campbell wanted to be able to get his authors to write about. So he prevails in the end, and that's really about it. So you get to the end of it, and you think, okay. It's just okay. It's sort of a 1950s novelette, and you sort of read it and you think, yeah, all right, but I don't think I won't go out of my way to reread that again. Now, a few people like Gardner Dazois thought it was a pretty good, tense, interesting novelette. Well, it's okay to read once, but that's about it in my view. I wouldn't go back again.
No.
So basically, that was all right. Now, the short story, we come to I don't know how you feel about this, but I would guess that a lot of people in the field would consider this to be one of the classics of the science fiction field, and that is The Star by Arthur C. Clarke. You've read this one?
Yeah, I reread it recently. It's nice, but it's a one-idea punchline sort of story, isn't it, really? It's one of those short stories that just really is all there to lead up to the punchline, which is not a jokey punchline. It's actually a punch in the gut sort of punchline, but it's well enough written, but it's quite short, and yep. It's just this basic idea. Do you want me to describe the plot?
You might as well. Look, I think we can basically assume that given that the thing was published over 40 years ago, then we don't worry about spoilers now. Yeah, if you don't want to hear what goes on in the story,
don't listen.
Turn off.
So basically, it's an exploration team visiting other planets. We, as part of the scientific team, we have a Jesuit priest. Jesuit priest seems to be feature major in science fiction when we're going on to explore other planets. We've got that in James Blishy's A Case of Conscience, and it was a Jesuit priest in The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. But in here, we also have a Jesuit priest. But he's a distinguished astrophysicist or something. I can't remember what exactly he is. But he's there for his scientific credentials, not for his religious credentials. So they visit this planet. They visit this star, and it's the remnant of a supernova. The whole star is blown up, and almost all the planets in the solar system have been melted and destroyed. But there's a very distant planet which would never have been habitable, kind of like Pluto in our solar system, or even further beyond, way out of the central part of the solar system. So it's actually survived as a solid object, but nevertheless, the surface has been melted by the huge impact of the supernova. And they discover on this planet that there's a kind of repository, a cultural repository, that the people who lived on a planet closer to the star must have been able to tell that the star was going to go bang. And they've created this repository on this very distant world in the hope that it will survive to carry on a bit of their culture. And so the scientific exploration team has been looking at all this, and these people appear to have been very good, very interesting culturally, very kind to their children, the whole bit. You know, they're really, really nice. They were really nice civilization, which has been completely wiped out by the explosion of this star. And of course, then we get to the punchline. And because this guy is a priest, he's very, very disturbed by this. Because the timing works out that this star that went bang must have been the star that we now know as the Star of Bethlehem that hung over the stable when Jesus was born. And so that's the huge conflict that the priest has. So it's a clever idea, and it's well enough written. But it is just a one idea sort of story, which I suppose in a short story that's forgivable.
It's only about 4 pages long.
Yeah, not very long.
So there's not much to it.
There's no real action, is there? It's all just a description of what actually occurred from the point of view of this priest. So it's a pretty good story, and it probably deserves to be a classic.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to know what it was up against as well. It was up against F.L. Wallace, End as a World.
Never heard of it.
I don't know F.L. Wallace. James Blish's King of the Hill. I don't know the story, but James Blish.
Yep.
Algie Budrus.
Algis Budrus.
Budrus.
Yeah.
Nobody Bothers Gus.
Never heard of it.
Cordwainer Smith, The Game of Rat and Dragon.
Right.
Cordwainer Smith is a very strange little writer, and I read Game of Rat and Dragon just recently as well, because when I saw that it was there, I thought, I don't remember that one, and that was rather an interesting little story.
Yeah.
Ray Bradbury's The Dragon. Robert Sheckley, Spy Story, which was published in Playboy back in 1955. That's
probably one of his jokey little stories, probably. Yeah.
Possibly. And Theodore Sturgeon, Twink. So you've got all males. There's a fair number of names there that we'd all recognise as being major writers in the field at that time. So anyway, so Arthur Clarke won that, his first Hugo Award for The Star. Yeah, look, it's going to be one of those ones that is always going to be anthologised. It's always going to end up as, you know, one of the greatest stories ever written. But as you've pointed out, it's really just a story leading to one punchline. That's it. And once you've read it, you go, yeah, okay, and that's it.
You know, it's interesting that the novel, both the novel and the novelette, were both published in Astounding magazine. And the Best Professional Magazine Award for this year was Astounding Science Fiction, as it was in a couple of previous award years. Astounding Science Fiction, run by John W. Campbell Jr., who there's no doubt was a great editor of the field, and indeed an award for new writers was named for him the John W. Campbell Award, but I believe, Perry, that there's been some controversy about that award. And is it being renamed?
Yes. Has it been renamed? It has been renamed. Well, firstly, there's a little bit of background we need to give you about this. Sometime back in the 50s, I think probably late 50s, maybe late 50s, the Hugo Awards did give out an award for best new writer, but I think it was only given out twice. I think it was probably given to Philip Jose Farmer and Robert Silverberg. So
yeah, Robert
not
Silverberg's
a bad...
down there for this year, yeah. For 56, yeah,
not...
yeah.
Yeah, not a bad couple, but the powers that be at the World Science Fiction Society decided that they didn't want to keep on running that Best New Writer Hugo. So it wasn't until about the 1970s, probably after Campbell had died, or maybe he had left Analog at that point and was no longer editor, that Dell Publishing, that is the people that published Astounding and then Analog later on, instituted the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. This is based, it's run alongside the Hugo Awards, but the World Science Fiction Society is at pains to point out it is not a Hugo Award. You do not get a Hugo statuette for your win. I think there's a check, and I think they also give out a tiara. All things now, was a bit strange, but it is, and also it's not an award for 1 year's work. It's an award for work leading up to that particular point, and it might well be that you've taken a couple of years to get to the point where you've got enough work published so that you can be noticed by people, but you can only be eligible for the award in 2 years. And if you're nominated 2 years in a row, that's it. And you don't win, you're gone. If you do win, you also can't be nominated again, so you can't win it twice. So if you get a win, that's it. Now, this year's awards, I must admit I was watching the awards, but I think we were, when I was watching it, on around a laptop, in a house in Dublin, because as we spoke about last week, it was difficult to get into the Hugo Awards. And so we basically all decided that we'd trot off home and have a glass of red and watch the awards there. And when the name was read out, Jeanette Ng, that's N-G, so I apologise if I've mispronounced that, we didn't really listen very closely to what she had to say when she came out. But it was fairly controversial in the sense that she basically came out and then started to get stuck into John Campbell and calling him a fascist,
yep,
amongst other things, and then went on to show her support for the protesters in Hong Kong. She's a Singaporean writer, so she's Asian, so she knew what she was talking about from that perspective. But this caused a bit of controversy, of course, and over the ensuing few days, a number of people had a number of comments to say. Some of them were saying that they agreed wholeheartedly with her. I believe that Elliot de Baudard had won an award, because there are actually two awards named for John W. Campbell inside the science fiction field. One of them is the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for Best Novel, which is a novel award handed out for books supposedly that would be ones that Campbell would have published, although some of the ones I've read I don't think he would have gone anywhere near. And also this award for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. These are run by two different people. As I said, Dell Publishing looks after the Best New Writer Award, and I believe there's the James Gunn organization somewhere in the US is the one that hands out the award for it's a juried award for the best novel. Anyway, somebody in the past had also basically had a bit of a shot at Campbell over the last couple of years, and it subsequently came out that Dell Publishing had taken on board a fair bit of the controversy that had come up and had decided that they were already thinking about changing the name of the award. And within probably a month after the end of the Worldcon, they put out a statement saying that they would be renaming the award, and that it would no longer be called the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. I'm not entirely sure what the new name is. It's probably Dell Publishing's Award for Best New Writer. It's still going to stay as the same process in terms of who can get nominated, and all the rest of the rules all stay the same. They're just changing the name of it. Now, I think that this also has came about partly because the World Fantasy Award a year or so back had a big problem with their actual award, not the name of it, but the actual award that it looks like. The Hugo Award, as you know, is an old 1950s style rocket spaceship. The World Fantasy Award was a bust of H.P. Lovecraft. And as somebody pointed out, who won it a few years back, said, she was a writer of colour, said, I find it a little bit difficult accepting this award, given that the person that is depicted on it would have wanted me dead. And that took a few people aback. The World Fantasy Association decided that it would probably be a good idea that they change the shape of the awards, which they have now done. It now depicts, I think, a full moon behind a gnarled tree. It looks pretty good. So they've changed that. So then there's the two John W. Campbell Awards that have now been changed. And it's also now rippled into the James Tiptree Jr. Award, where there's been a big controversy over that. Though we're hoping to get a bit more details about where that is at the moment. I'm not entirely sure what's happening with that, but there's controversy over that in terms of the way that Tiptree finished her life. She had a murder-suicide pact with her husband, although some people are going to say that that isn't proven and that she was actually a murderer. But I don't know. I'm not deeply enough into the whole of that particular argument and debate to be able to give a succinct description of what's gone on. But it's really basically coming to the point where a number of awards inside the science fiction field are now going, especially those that are named after particular people, are going to come under scrutiny. And I think probably the next one that'll come there will be the Arthur C. Clarke Award. There are rumours about his sexual proclivities. We know that he was gay, but whether he how he manifested that is under discussion at the moment. So keep an eye on that one. That may well be changing. And of course, Hugo Gernsback himself was not necessarily the world's paragon of virtue, nor in terms of his feelings towards minorities or women or anybody else. So there may be a bit of a push on that one, although I can't really see that the Hugos are ever going to get changed. I think that the Hugo Awards are basically going to remain as such, and that'll be just it. But watch this space.
Yeah, I guess it does raise the issue of naming any kind of award or building or whatever after someone many years after the event. You may discover that there's something that they did wrong, or that they had bad attitudes or whatever. And I can sympathize with that, but only to a certain extent. I mean, you know, things are of their time, and you can't excuse racist views or homophobic views, but you know, I'm not sure, certain that it's necessarily the right thing to do to just retrospectively cancel things, or you know, throw aspersions on someone. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much of a fascist John W. Campbell was. I can sort of see the point of view, but I think I'd have to look at a lot more evidence to be really convinced. My big thing against John W. Campbell was how much he promoted L. Ron Hubbard and the Dianetics thing, which eventually became Scientology.
Yeah,
that's certainly a crime against humanity, if you ask me. But
yes, I'd agree, and I think that he really did something very poor there. Whether that was poor judgment or whether he was joking around, because whatever it was, though, that it was the wrong thing to have done. But Yeah, anyway, it's in the past.
It doesn't stop him having been a good editor. And there's no doubt that as an editor, he inculcated a lot of very important talent. And I've seen it said that Frank Herbert's Dune would never have been anywhere near as successful if John W. Campbell hadn't been on Frank Herbert's back the whole time, getting him to change things.
But
I could be wrong about that. But it's just a bit dubious to me as to automatically say, oh, well, that person committed suicide, so they shouldn't get an award named after them, or. I don't know the details of the Tiptree thing, so I probably shouldn't comment, but there you go. But it's interesting. Nonetheless, yep. It's very interesting.
It's showing a massive change in the field in terms of how they're viewing the history of the field. So they're reevaluating what's happened in the past and what's been done.
The other thing I should say to be fair is that it's very easy for me as a white male to say, oh, well, that's not important. But women, gay people, minority groups, you know, they suffer so much discrimination against them that they have every right to be more sensitive to these issues than I can be. So I think that's probably just a disclaimer I ought to say.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said, I think it's just it is a change in the field, and I think that what we're finding is that there will be more re-evaluations going on, and as you pointed out, it is probably not a good thing to name awards after particular people.
Yeah.
So it's basically, you're better off not doing that, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about the Oscar, you talk about the Hugos possibly having to be renamed, but... I mean, the Oscars, at least, it's only a casual name. And in fact, wasn't it the statuette reminded someone of their Uncle Oscar or something?
Wasn't that
how the Oscars became?
Yeah, so they're not actually named after it. It's just a nickname.
I think that's okay. I don't think they're likely to have to retract that name.
So, no, I think you're right. So, David, talking about the 1956 Hugos, as we were, and then talking about the award controversy that happened at Dublin reminds me that I hadn't actually gone through the winners of the Hugos for 2019. We discussed a lot of this stuff earlier on before I went to Dublin, yep. Because I'd read through everything and I gave you my feelings about who I was going to vote for and what I thought was going to win.
Yep.
And as is usual, I did really well this year. If I was a betting man, I'd be in deep, deep trouble. I picked one out of four of the big fiction awards.
Yep.
So the novel, best novel, was The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Cowell. That was the one that you read. So you actually did very well. You picked one book to read off the whole list, and that was the one that won. So that was really fortuitous.
Yeah.
So what it's like. So this book's done well this year, really. It's it picked up the Nebula, the Hugo, and the Locus SF Award. So that's the big three. But am I going to remember it in 10 years' time and look back on it and say, ooh, was that as good as Ancillary Justice from a few years back? And I'm going to go, no, probably not. I mean, this is not to denigrate the novel. It's an excellent, excellent book. I think I had it as number two. I had Spinning Silver as my choice. But anyway, that's the way it goes. So I missed out on that one.
Yeah. And it's
novella.
It's good characterization and interesting sort of concept, but it's not... again, from a science fictional point of view, there's not. It's really more of an alternate history sort of book than science fiction itself. Interestingly enough, I get the feeling, I've been looking at the Apple TV Plus trailers that this new service that Apple is going to be introducing later in the year. And they've got a TV series called For All Mankind, which almost seems to have some similarities to the Calculating Stars. It's again an alternate history about the space race.
Yep.
And the women astronauts are a major part of it. So I'm not sure if they've cribbed that from the book or whether they've had any deal with the author of the book, but there certainly seem to be similarities in the concept. So that'll be interesting.
Well, that might be some homework for you to try and figure
that out. Well, I'll be having a look at the full series when they do release that service, I would say.
All right. Novella, won by Artificial Condition. And yes, I picked this. Yep. Yay, got one. So this is quite good. It's in that series of the Murderbot, which I quite like, and I would recommend you go and read those. They're quite interesting. The first one in particular was the best of them, I think, because, again, it's like, oh, this is a new concept. And by the time you get through to about the third or fourth one, you think, yeah, well, I've heard this concept before. Maybe time to move on. But I still think that it holds together pretty well, and it ticks along very nicely. And so I would recommend that one.
Yep.
The best novelette went to Zen Cho for If at First You Don't Succeed, Try Again. I have absolutely no recollection of this particular story at all. I didn't vote for it. I had this one third, I think. My favourite, I think, was The Last Banquet of Temporal Confections, which I do remember, and I remember fondly, and I thought that was really quite good. So that was just one out of the box, but there we go. Best short story, A Witch's Guide to Escape, a practical compendium of portal fantasies. Again, didn't pick this one. I went for The Secret Lives of the Nine Negro Teeth of George Washington, which I spoke about and still remember that one really quite well.
Yep.
Don't remember much about The Witch's Guide, although I did read it. It was one of my favourites early, but then it faded because The Secret Lives of the Nine Negro Teeth just kept on hanging around in my head. And so that was the one that kicked on. Anyway, so interesting to note that we had all four fiction categories won by women. Don't know whether that's happened before. Probably not. I wouldn't have thought. Then the best series. Oh, and also there was a bit of a change in it, Dublin, in that the best series, Hugo, which had been really just there on trial for a couple of years, was accepted to be continued and is going to now carry on and be continuing. Frankly, I don't think it's doing what the original proposers of the award hoped it would do. I just don't think it's I just don't think it's hitting the mark very well. The best series this year was given to Wayfarers by Becky Chambers. This is the Becky Chambers' Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, which is an excellent title but and an okay book. But the next two of them were so-so. But anyway, so Wayfarers by Becky Chambers won that. There was a bit of controversy about the best related work this year because it was won by Archive of Our Own, a project of the Organisation for Transformative Works.
What's that?
This is basically a fan fiction repository. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of people that are not really very happy about it having picked it up.
No.
Anyway, we'll go down to Best Dramatic Presentation Long Form, which was won by Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, it's good. I'm not sure it deserves to be Hugo, isn't it?
Yeah, you really like that. My son also really liked that. I think I voted for Avengers Infinity War, but hey, that's just me. Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form, The Good Place, Janet's, episode called Janet's. Not sure why, when The Expanse had a really good episode there, and there were two Doctor Who episodes in the list as well. So that was a bit strange. But anyway, The Good Place seems to have a lot of followers. And so that's the Hugo Awards. So you can find the full list, because I haven't gone through the full list. There's probably about another six or eight of them there. You can find the full list at the Hugo Awards, all one word, .org. And if you go looking on there, that's the official Hugo Awards site that you can have a look at, and you'll get the full list of all of them. By now, I would think somewhere or other, all of the voting details have been published, so you can work out which author dropped off first or which work dropped off first, and how well the voting went for the winners. But an interesting year. I don't really think it's a 2018 was a strong year for science fiction. I think it's a sort of a small transformative step without it being a big stride forward, with where you get something that's like, oh my God, this is fantastic, stepping out again, like ancillary justice that I thought was just wonderful a few years back. And I thought that was a big change, but nothing was close to that in 2018. But there we go.
All right. Okay, Perry, that's been an interesting session to talk about those books and those awards. But that's more than enough for today's episode, I think. So we'll say goodbye for now. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Okay.
And we'll see you hopefully in a couple of weeks. Indeed. All right. Thanks, David.
Okay. Ciao. Bye.
Bye.